Today on Athens News Matters, Athens-Clarke County Mayor Kelly Gertz on the pandemic's effect on city finances.
Fortunately, we've been very careful with use of our funds over the last several years, and so that's meant that we've got a little bit of a buffer.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, the challenges facing clinics serving the most vulnerable populations.
After the summer hits, if things haven't turned around from a financial viewpoint, I think a lot of the nonprofits are going to be having some serious hurt.
Plus, Kent Kilpatrick from Athens-Clarke County Leisure Services joins us to talk about parks that reopened this week and whether area youth will have summer programs this year.
Those stories, our panel on the continuing saga of EMS service in Athens, plus the weekend news and more, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia, Sao Paulo,
Beirut, London.
Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Access to health care has become a large part of both the national and the community conversation amid the COVID-19 pandemic. For patients experiencing both coronavirus-related symptoms and unrelated health concerns. In Athens, nonprofit health clinics such as the Athens Nurses Clinic, Mercy Health Center, and Athens Neighborhood Health provide free critical services to those who otherwise couldn't afford it. But the pandemic has brought new challenges to the clinics. Savannah Sicarella filed this report.
Paige Cummings is the executive director of the Athens Nurses Clinic. And beyond the need to continue to provide treatment to its clients, she says the clinic faces a delicate balancing act with its finances.
We closed the physical clinic. We started calling all of our clients. And so we would call them. We would do assessments over the phone. We would prepare their prescriptions and send them over to the BioWise pharmacy where Mr. Brewer takes care of our patients. Then over-the-counter meds are here. So we would pack up their over-the-counter meds in little food bags, and we would take those over to BioWise to be waiting for the clients to come by. If someone was acutely ill, they would come by and stay in their car. And a nurse practitioner in full PPE gear, mask, shield, head covering, gowns, we would go down to the car and we would check them out.
Funding from local hospitals has decreased because they have not received federal money to cover losses from the COVID-19 pandemic, Cummings said. As a result of the lowered funding, big sponsors discontinuing community service benefits, and the clinic's inability to hold summertime fundraising events, the Athens Nurses Clinic now has to rely more on donations than they did in the past and look for alternative fundraising measures. But the community support has not entirely dwindled. The clinic is receiving food from Feed the Frontlines, personal protective equipment from MedShare in Atlanta, and community donations to their PayPal account.
But in general, the people in Athens, they look for ways to be able to help. I got phone calls from people saying, do you have enough personal protective equipment? Would you like us to make you some of the masks that we're busy making? And so they did that.
But the bigger concern, Cummings says, is that everyone in Georgia needs help. And there's going to be a point where donations to free clinics start dwindling down.
As long as we have the payroll protection program, which goes through May 28th, which helps small businesses be able to keep their staff, and the free clinic is considered a small business under those numbers. So I'm thinking we can keep going through the summer. But after the summer hits, if things haven't turned around from a financial viewpoint, I think a lot of the nonprofits are going to be having some serious hurt.
If the clinics have to limit operations, the consequences will trickle down to community members they typically serve. Without any kind of health care for their patients, the free clinics are going to overload the other systems, according to Brian Seagraves, the director of the Hepatitis C Treatment Clinic at Mercy Health Center and a member of the Athens Nurses Clinic Board.
The problem with that is, though, if you know the patients we see are not, they don't have insurance. They don't qualify for Georgia Medicaid. They're what I call the working poor, sometimes the homeless who don't qualify. They can't get anything under the Affordable Care Health Care Act. I mean, you know, they still have to pay a premium with that. They still have co-pays. These people really can't afford that.
If they don't get their diabetes medication or their Lancets and their test strips for making sure they know what their blood sugar is, if our hypertensive patients don't get their blood pressure medication, our patients with gout or asthma don't get their respiratory care things, then they're going to end up having to go to the emergency room. And with COVID out, our clients are at such high risk anyway. So we're telling our clients, stay in, stay home, stay healthy. Call us if you have an issue.
The Athens Nurses Clinic reopened the week of May 18th with increased safety precautions. But the clinic is still encouraging community members to continue donating and volunteering with other free clinics. Donations to help out with medication and lab costs are always encouraged. But clinics are also in need of bulk resources like vitamins or ibuprofen and volunteers to help write thank you notes to previous donors. Seagrave says that history tells us the local community will step up.
I have always found, though, that the Athens community, the citizens, the government, has always jumped in there and gotten the fray with us and everything else. So I don't think they're going to let us down. They haven't in the past, and I just don't think they will.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Savannah Ciccarella.
If you want to learn more about the local health clinics we mentioned in this story, see our website at wuga.org.
There's still a lot of uncertainty surrounding the pandemic, whether we'll see additional surges, what the economic toll will be, and locally, what UGA classes will look like in the fall. Earlier this week, I spoke to Athens-Clark County Mayor Kelly Gertz about how the city is doing and the path forward. First, thank you, Mayor Gertz, for joining us today.
And glad to be here.
And I want to start with the current state of affairs in Athens. So how's our healthcare system doing?
Well, the publicly available information about the healthcare, and you can see this through the Department of Public Health's website and through GEMA, Georgia Emergency Management's website, which provides some different information. They give bed capacity and the like. Demonstrates that we're doing largely well in Athens. And so I'll give an enormous amount of credit to the broader community who battened down the hatches early on in this crisis. And so I'll give a lot of credit to advanced manufacturers from Carrier to our own large poultry processing facility at Pilgrim's Pride for being really diligent in making sure that they were undergoing the sort of safety review that was going to mean operational changes to benefit their employees. We haven't had the kind of outbreaks that some other poultry or meat processing facilities in the state and in the country have seen. So now in retail environments, do I see all the behavior that I wish for? Absolutely not. And so that's what some of the coming messaging is going to be around.
So you mentioned some area companies. How are locally owned businesses doing in Athens?
Well, I mean, certainly economically, they've taken an enormous hit, and particularly in those areas where we've seen challenges nationally, hoteliers, bar and nightlife, obviously. I mean, those are places that are going to take a long time to bounce back. So one of the programs that we're going to be capitalizing in the next few weeks here is a locally focused lending instrument for small businesses. And so I'm recommending to the County Commission that we capitalize that small business loan fund with about $1 million to create some no interest loan opportunities and get some dollars out the door, hopefully no later than June.
You've also had to work on next year's budget. Now that is certainly challenging under these times, but can you tell us a little bit about what that budget is looking like?
Sure. I'll mention first what the anticipated end date is. We anticipate that the County Commission is going to vote on the fiscal year 2021 budget on June 16th. And so that would be for the budget year that begins July 1st and goes through the following June 30th. What I have proposed are reductions in some existing fee structures. So I've proposed a slight lowering of the millage rate by an eighth of a point. And we've also proposed that we lower water and sewer fees. We've got over a decade of experience now in a tiered water structure, and we think that we can lower that fee structure somewhat and not damage our environmental resources in terms of overuse of water. One of the things I'm recommending in the budget is almost 10 new employees in our 911 operation so we can transition into a fully integrated 911 system in which you don't have to first call 911 and then potentially be routed to a second operation if it's a medical and an ambulatory need. Fortunately, we've been very careful with use of our funds over the last several years, and so that's meant that we've got a little bit of a buffer.
I also want to give you a chance to clear up some pushback regarding property taxes. Can you sort of clarify what's actually going on with property taxes?
I'd be glad to do that. If you think about property taxes, really there are two variables. There's the rate of taxation, or what I described earlier as the millage rate, and then there's the value of that individual property or that property assessment. So the assessor works for a board of assessors that's separate from the mayor and commission, because what you don't want is elected leadership putting their thumb on the scale in one direction or another to push property values up or to push them down. So the board of assessors with the assessment staff goes out and they determine what is market value for a property. What the county commission does, along with myself, is sets that rate of taxation or that millage rate. And so again, we're pushing the millage rate down under my recommendation at least, but some people will find that their property is more valuable in 2020 than it was in 2019. We have seen, you know, many properties that have gone up in assessment by 4, 5, or 6%.
Well, thank you, Mayor Gertz, for joining us today.
Thank you, Alexia.
Kelly Gertz is the mayor of Athens-Clarke County.
My name is Jessica Wurst, and I've been a grad assistant for WUGA since January. I was actually an intern 2 years ago, producing a few feature stories here and there. I came back as an assistant because I fell in love with the environment and the people at WUGA. Since the pandemic started, I did this one piece about sexual assault victims and quarantine, and that was such a powerful story. I really enjoyed covering that piece.
Learn more about WUGA internships at wuga.org. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Joining me now to discuss this week in news and politics are Blake Aud from Flagpole, Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd, and Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner Herald. Let's start once again with a story that we've been discussing for a while, the long-running EMS saga, particularly the EMS Oversight Committee. Chris, I know you've done a lot of reporting on this issue. Can you fill us in with a little background to start?
Where should I start? In 2018, this public safety advocate, Sam Raffle, and Bob Gadd, who are EMTs, Bob's a paramedic, he used to work for National, and they were able to get some data from the State Department of Public Health, and that showed that National maybe weren't meeting their required response times in their contract, but that was disputed by the hospitals. And so, and we never have been able to get the raw data from National themselves. And so it's just been an ongoing question about what the response times actually are, which set of data is correct, which isn't. Let's see. And then recently, so there is an oversight committee who is supposed to be, you know, making sure everything is good with National's performance. But recently they've actually stopped meeting. There's been a request by the county government to open up their meetings. So the county attorney thinks that their meetings should be open to the public according to the open meetings laws. But so they've actually stopped meeting. And so we're just kind of in a situation where they're not really communicating with the public anymore about what the response times are, but there are these real questions about it that are hanging in the air.
Well, the hospitals don't want them to be open. The hospitals have said they don't think that they should be open. They don't want them to be open. And the argument is that because National EMS is a private company, that the open records laws don't apply here. And You know, I'm not a lawyer, but I know a little bit about open records law, and I don't really think that flies. I agree with the county attorney. When you've got two governments, Oconee County and Clark County, and the hospitals are public entities. Athens Regional's meetings are open to the public, their board meetings. I've been to them before. So you've got four public entities and one private entity involved, and you have public money involved, and I think those meetings need to be open to the public. I mean, when a private business comes to a commission meeting and gives testimony, you know, maybe for a rezoning or something, they don't close commission meetings for that. So I don't really understand the logic. I mean,
who's
it just seems like they just want
to.
That's the question. That's the big question. You know, is the county going to push this? You know, I mean, it really should be the press, but honestly, like, I don't know if anybody, I don't think any of us has enough money to really go sue anyone over this right now. So it's probably not going to be us. Is it going to be the county government? You know, maybe someone will complain to the attorney general. Maybe the attorney general could step in. You know, there are other organizations, the First Amendment organizations that I know are looking into this who could have the resources to push the issue. So that remains to be seen.
So does the oversight committee basically have like carte blanche? They can do whatever. There's no one for them to have to answer to?
Well, it was convened by the hospital, right? And so they're kind of, by both hospitals together. And so there are representatives from the local governments, both in Athens and from Oconee. But I mean, they're just, you know, two people on the committee. So it's, yeah, I mean, basically they're running the show. So it's.
And they had been sworn to secrecy too, hadn't they before?
Yeah. Yeah. They had to sign non-disclosure agreements about those meetings.
I would think that just given the distrust that's built up about this, that they would want some more openness. But both hospitals here have not been very forthcoming with information in general, not just about ambulance service, but about what's going on during the pandemic.
One thing that may help with this is that in the budget that they're talking about right now, they may be getting the money to actually combine the 911 centers. So if you call 911 right now, you have to tell your emergency twice, once to the county's 911 operators and once to National EMS because the call gets transferred. But if this goes through in the budget, then that will eliminate those two different departments and it'll just consolidate into one. And so then all the data will be available at that point because it'll be from a public agency, so we'll be able to, it'll be publicly available.
Well, that's good for transparency.
Yes, absolutely.
Will that really take care of this problem, do you think, Chris?
I mean, we'll be able to at least know what the response times are at that point, and the county will be the ones dispatching the ambulances. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think it'll solve a lot of the problem. Now, what happens if we get this information and we find out that, you know, National really isn't meeting its required response times, and then what do
right.
we do? I'm not sure what we do then, but.
They have been accused of favoring non-emergency transports because those are more profitable. I guess that will shed some light on that too eventually.
I think it would.
Well, what's next? When they're, you know, all the meetings have been canceled, so basically there's no movement.
Right. I mean, I guess if they don't have the meetings anymore, then they wouldn't be getting the $100,000 subsidy from both counties. So that's a disadvantage for them if they go down that road. But hopefully they'll open up the meetings here soon.
Have the hospitals expressed an opinion on whether they like the new dispatch regime that's being proposed here, where the county would pretty much take that over?
I haven't heard on that one.
I haven't heard opposition to it, but I don't know that I've heard an endorsement of it either.
Well, I guess we're, like you said, in a little bit of a holding pattern. Let's speak of another item happening around Athens, actually involving local attorney Deborah Gonzalez and a group of voters from Athens and Oconee County suing the governor and secretary of state due to the postponement of the district attorney's race. They are protesting the 2018 law, which allows the governor to appoint the DA, and they want voters to have that choice. And I'm sure, Blake, you have some history on this because you're always my history person.
Right, yeah, because the governor did not appoint an interim district attorney to replace Ken Malden when Ken Malden resigned in February. He's waited too long, and now it's less than 6 months before the November election. And what that means, because of the law you mentioned, which was passed a couple of years ago in response to something to do with like Douglas County or Paulding County or something, I think. So the election will not be held this November. It will be held in November of 2022, because if the appointment is not made at least 6 months before the election gets pushed back for 2 years. You know, and this is the second time that it's actually been pushed back, because when Malden resigned, that made it a special election. So there was supposed to be a primary in May. Well, then the primary got moved to June, but now there is no primary because it's a special election. And so there's no more primary. There's just the November election. And now there's not even that. Now it's 2022. So this keeps getting pushed back. And Deborah Gonzalez, who's been planning on running all along, is not happy about that, obviously. And she is now filed a lawsuit in federal court saying that this law is unconstitutional and it deprives people of their right to choose an elected official, of their right to vote.
Do you see this lawsuit as very much different than that of John Barrow, who also sued because of a similar situation? The governor is going to appoint someone to a Supreme Court justice position.
Yeah. There's two big differences here. Number one, Malden already resigned and the seat is open. The Supreme Court justice that you're talking about hasn't resigned yet. He just said he's going to. He's not resigned right until November, so the seat's not technically open. And the second thing is, Barrow filed his lawsuit in Superior Court, state court, and Gonzalez filed hers in federal court.
Also, I think there's a pretty specific clause in the Georgia Constitution that says that the DA has to be, there has to be an election every 4 years for that. That may be a difference as well.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that they're saying. But it's a little bit squishy with appointments, because it's like, what is judicial? You know, I mean, there's just a lot of questions, legal questions surrounding some of the language in there. So, and it's not uncommon with judicial appointments. I mean, it's actually customary for a judge to resign and give the governor the opportunity to appoint someone to the seat who would then run for re-election instead of leaving it open. But that tradition doesn't exist for other offices.
But aren't those nonpartisan, technically, the judges' seats have to be, they're nonpartisan, and DAs have to choose a party?
That's another big difference here.
Yeah, like
the DA
judges.
Is a partisan office. But the principle that we should be able to elect people into these elected offices is not different, I don't think.
That is all our time for this week. I want to thank my guests, Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd, Lee Scher from the Athens Banner Herald, and Blake Aud from Flagpole Magazine. In reference to our discussion regarding EMS service, full disclosure, St. Mary's is an underwriter with WUGA. Stay with us. Coming up in about 5 minutes, we'll have a conversation with candidate for District Attorney Deborah Gonzalez about a lawsuit she filed this week against Governor Brian Kemp.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup.
Former state representative and current candidate for district attorney Deborah Gonzalez, along with several voters, is suing the governor and the secretary of state over a controversial decision to postpone the DA's election for 2 years. She joins us now to discuss that lawsuit. So, Deborah Gonzalez, I want to thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell me about this action. I understand this is a civil rights suit against Governor Kemp, correct?
Yes, it is a civil rights lawsuit. It's been filed in the federal court, Northern District in Atlanta, and it is against Governor Kemp and the Secretary of State in their official capacity. And basically, I, as well as the four other plaintiffs who are voters who reside in Athens and Oconee County, are claiming that what the governor has done because of this 2018 law has violated our constitutional rights of free speech as well as our voting rights. Basically, the argument is that this law gives so much discretion to the governor that it can, in fact, lead to a situation where from this point on, every DA is actually appointed and not elected. And we have guaranteed in the Georgia Constitution that we, the citizens, are the ones to elect a DA every 4 years.
And what would you like to see happen? Would you like this once again back in the hands of the voters?
Exactly. That's where it should be. That's what's guaranteed by the Georgia Constitution, and that's what's supported by the U.S. Constitution. When we put out our little press release, we also put out some of the prior cases that sort of talk about the importance. And, you know, when we talk about First Amendment and freedom of speech, we're also talking about a freedom of association. And there was a case in 1983, Anderson versus Celebrese. And the quote from the decision there, I think, brings this home. And it says, the exclusion of candidates also burdens voters' freedom of association, because an election campaign is an effective platform for the expression of views on the issues of the day, and a candidate serves as a rallying point for like-minded citizens. And so there are many rights that are being violated, and that's why we felt it was so important to file this lawsuit. What we are asking in terms of relief is that the law, the 2018 law, is struck down, and that the Secretary of State immediately puts an election for DA on the November 2020 ballot.
And there is still time right now to accomplish that if this proceeds quickly.
Absolutely. And we have every reason to believe that it will. We filed the lawsuit early in the morning on Monday, and within an hour, we had a judge already appointed. That is a good sign for us that they're taking it seriously, that they want to get this through, even though we're in a judicial emergency. So we're hoping that this can be resolved so that we can get back on the campaign trail and give it back to the people where this decision needs to be made and where it should be made. The people need to decide who should be their DA.
As it stands now, Deborah, right now you have to wait 2 years before an election can take place.
That's right. Effectively, the election for DA for 2020 was canceled. And so the next election would be in 2022. But we are hoping that we will be successful in this lawsuit, that the judge will see that the voters are the ones who should be deciding who their DA is, especially with the role that, you know, the DAs are so important. They have such power and discretion and authority to make decisions that affect not only one individual's lives, but families, generations, communities. And so it's really important that the community get to vote for somebody who they feel reflects their values.
Well, thank you, Deborah Gonzalez, for joining us today.
Thank you, Alexia. Stay safe.
This fall, the University of Georgia School of Social Work is launching what appears to be the state's first certification program for substance use counseling. The timing couldn't be better. Like most other states, Georgia faces a shortage of certified substance use counselors, and experts say substance use is rising during the pandemic, fueled by isolation and other stressors.
And Allison Salerno has that story.
Julia Dale came to Athens 5 years ago after she landed a job as program director at Alliance Recovery Center. That's a treatment center off Atlanta Highway that helps people with addiction to opioids and other substances. But when Dale tried to hire counselors for those clients, she ran into trouble.
I think primarily I was interviewing people
therapist and finding that they had very little substance abuse experience or education. It was sort of an afterthought. Like they got a job in the addiction field and loved it and then decided to get the education.
She ended up spending a lot of her time coaching the counselors on how to work with those clients.
Providing the education that I feel like they could have gotten through their master's program or through the certificate boards.
Dale's career brought her to Georgia from her home state of North Carolina, where she'd earned a master's degree in social work. The University of Georgia's certificate in substance use is modeled on the one at Chapel Hill.
So when I got my master's, I essentially did a minor in substance abuse, which was 4 courses. But when I graduated, I just had to take the test. And then I had the licensure needed to work in substance abuse.
And as it turns out, UGA social work dean Anna Chayette was an assistant dean at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill when Dale was a social work graduate student there.
And so I approached her and, you know, told her that I remembered her being the assistant dean there and that I had went through the UNC substance abuse certificate program. And I told her that I saw the need for that here because of the lack of experience and education that I was finding that therapist candidates had when I interviewed them.
Professor Orion Mowbray, who oversees the program, says the coursework will prepare students well.
We have a high confidence that they'll be able to enter the field quickly, provide ethical, evidence-informed care that will provide the most possible benefit to persons in need of substance use treatment.
The need for trained substance use counselors is greater than ever. Over the past 10 years, use of opioids in Georgia has become an epidemic. Death rates by opioid drug overdose, whether by synthetic painkillers like fentanyl or by heroin, keep rising. And the number of trained counselors has not kept up. The current COVID-19 pandemic is causing more stress, emotional and financial, for many, and that includes people struggling with addiction. Recovery centers like Alliance have had to cancel in-person therapy groups, and many clients lack access to technology for Zoom meetings. Mowbray, the University of Georgia professor, says demand for substance use therapists is growing exponentially.
So we know from the Department of Labor and other federal sources that the demand for substance use and mental health treatment all throughout the nation is growing at a larger rate than the available counselors to provide it. So in a response to help out and address the growing need, we've created a way to provide more intensive training to graduate level students who have an interest in going into this area through our certificate program.
The substance use certification program has room this fall for up to 20 students. Already 9 have signed up. Mowbray says the program can expand over time. He says students will finish with a thorough understanding of substance use and the latest evidence-based practices for its treatment. He's a man who has devoted his entire professional career to studying opioid addiction. There are 2 things he wishes more people understood.
And the first is that it's important to recognize substance use and mental health problems on the same level as the physical health problems that we all experience. We need to have care available for them. They need to be recognized as lifelong potential disabilities. I think the second piece is that the other misconception I see often is that persons with substance use problems should be able to handle these things on their own. Simply not the case. There's no shame in asking for help.
Help that will come in part from the first cohort of substance use trained counselors and from subsequent students. For Athens News Matters, this is Allison Salerno.
If you are struggling with addiction or other issues, Georgia has a 24-hour hotline. For access to services and immediate crisis help, call the Georgia Crisis and Access Line at 800-715-4225. As the mid-August deadline for the 2020 U.S. Census approaches, local complete count committees are organizing to ensure the community is informed on the purpose, privacy, and security of the census. Grace Bagwell Adams, a faculty member in the University of Georgia's College of Public Health, is also a member of the Census Complete Count Committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Why is it so crucial to respond to the census? Explain that for me.
So it is critically important really for two main reasons. The first is that it's the count from the U.S. Census that happens every 10 years that determines political representation. So in the state of Georgia, for example, in the last census, we actually got an additional House of Representatives member because our population had increased and that was reflected in the census count. And so in a state like Georgia, for example, where our population has been growing significantly, especially over the last few decades, it's really important that that population is counted correctly so that we have adequate representation in the House of Representatives and Congress at the national level. In addition to determining representation, the census also actually is used to determine allocation of federal benefits through major social programs. So when we undercount certain groups of people, and especially families with young children, when we undercount those children, then our community actually loses federal funding as a function of that undercount.
Well, you mentioned accurately. What's the importance of including complete, accurate information on your census?
Athens-Clarke County is actually in a federally designated hard-to-count area, which is determined by the U.S. Census Bureau. And what that means is there have been groups that have been systematically undercounted by the census in previous attempts. And we know that the undercount actually has patterns in the population. So the specific groups that are most likely to be undercounted in our community are young children, so those that are five and under, and Latino families. And so when those individuals and those households aren't counted, then we really don't have an accurate picture of not only how many people are in our community, but the demographic composition.
You know, there's an interesting public service announcement that's out right now regarding the counting of college-age students. In fact, it says something to the effect, don't worry if you live in the university's dorm, they will count you. And I thought to myself, I have a college-age student in the house who I have already counted. So is there a risk there of a double count, or how does that work?
Absolutely. So it does get a little bit complex. But the bottom line message is that for students who are in college and those who would have been on campus on April 1st, and that's tens of thousands of individuals in Athens-Clarke County, they should respond based on where they would have been April 1st. Even if they're currently living with their parents now, they should respond as if they would have been in Athens. And that is important because a lot of students assume that because their parents, for example, still cover them with their health insurance, or because they are claimed on their parents' taxes, for example, that their parents just count them in the household for the census. But that's actually not the appropriate way to get counted for the census.
I am so glad you clarified that for me personally. I've been wondering about that for a while now. Grace Bagwell Adams is a faculty member in the UGA College of Public Health, a researcher for the Athens Wellbeing Project, and a member of the Census Complete Count Committee. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. When social distancing policies took effect, many Athens residents found their means of income suddenly limited. The artists of Athens are no exception. Without venues to feature their craft or close access to their creative partners, or ready access to vital tools, or in some cases, even a job at all, Athens artists have faced an even greater challenge in continuing their craft and maintaining their way of life. In response to this crisis, the Athens Arts Alliance administered an online survey in order to assess the impact of the virus on the artistic community. Lauren Fancher is the executive director of Athica, the Athens Institute of Contemporary Art, and part of the Athens Art Alliance. Lauren, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, that survey reported that the majority of artists might lose between 25% to 100% of their income because of this crisis. How damaging could a loss like that be for a career or an aspiring artist?
Well, I think it's a real crisis for a lot of people, especially our younger generation who have been really working in the gig economy, and all of those gigs have been shut down. I think for Athens as a community to potentially lose a whole cohort because of economic impacts would be really devastating to our culture.
The two support opportunities with the greatest interest seem to be project-based grants and post-COVID-19 programs. What would those entail, and why do you think these have the greatest appeal?
Project-based grants tend to appeal to the funders as well as the recipients, because they work around defined deliverables for a defined amount of support. And then the ideas around post-COVID support, I think, really have their roots in pre-COVID conditions, that many of our artists were already struggling in the local economy, especially in the rent department. As Athens has grown, it's become a lot more competitive. For the very people that chose to stay here because of the cost of living being reasonable and being able to do cultural projects.
Let me ask you this, Lauren. How can Athens residents support their artists?
Well, one thing that everyone can do is to let the mayor and commission know how important it is to keep the arts vibrant in Athens through resiliency programs such as the one that they're funding for the Athens Cultural Affairs Commission, as well as future efforts that we could look at for more support for artists living in Athens, such as affordable housing, affordable studio space, and ongoing programs. In addition, to look at how nonprofit organizations such as Athica and others, Nucci Space, can be supported through collaborative partnerships and programming.
Lauren Fancher is the executive director of Athica, part of the Athens Arts Alliance. Thank you once again for joining us, Lauren.
Many Athens parks reopened, at least partially this week, giving locals another option to get out and enjoy the delightful spring we've been having. Here to talk about the reopening is the Director of Leisure Services in Athens-Clarke County, Kent Kilpatrick. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about what parks have actually been reopened and what people need to know to use those parks.
Well, our linear parks, which is our Greenway and Firefly Trails, our multi-use paths, have been opening since the beginning of the pandemic. They have never shut down.
Right.
Because they provide that opportunity for people to get exercise and get out and enjoy nature, but you can continue to move. But just this week, we did open a second round of parks, and these are some of our outdoor or nature-type parks that also have trails. These parks that opened this week include Sandy Creek Park, Memorial Park. What used to be Trail Creek Park has now got a new name, Virginia Walker Park, and Ben Burton Park. So each of these are available now during their regular hours of operation, but it's important for everyone to understand that there's components within these parks that may not be accessible.
Right.
High-touch areas like playgrounds, the beach at Sandy Creek Park, the zoo at Memorial Park, those things have to stay off limits for very obvious reasons. We want to go into this very carefully so that we're not a contributor to any reoccurrence or spreading of the virus.
You've been open for nearly a week. I'm sure that people are clamoring to be able to use these facilities. So how crowded have they been so far?
I talked with staff at Sandy Creek Park yesterday, And they went back and compared May 20th of last year to May 20th of this year. And even though Tuesday was somewhat of a cloudy and cool day, the day started a little rainy, they wound up exceeding the attendance from last year, which show on records it was a sunny day. It was very obvious that people were just wanting to get outdoors.
So far, does it look like they're following the rules?
They seem to be. We've put up signs in each of the locations. We've barricaded and put caution tape in our playgrounds. People so far seem to understand and just appreciate they have a place to go.
Good. Well, I know that summer programs are very popular. Can you give us an update on whether area youth will have access to summer programming?
The June camps and the pools for the month of June have been shut down to protect both staff and the citizens. Right now, we have targeted to provide both during the month of July. As a matter of fact, we added additional camp opportunities during July so that we can try to provide some type of normal summer.
Well, certainly not exactly the sort of summer we're all used to, but it sounds like you guys are doing everything you can to give Athenians at least a taste of what we have grown accustomed to from the Leisure Services Department, and thank you so much for those efforts.
Well, thank you, and I also want to encourage people to be able to go to the website. We've got a new virtual programming page, and since the shutdown started, we've begun doing a lot of virtual programming. We had our first big virtual event last Saturday with a snake day.
Well, give us that website information.
It's accc.gov.com/leisure.
Kent Kilpatrick is Athens Clark County Director of Leisure Services. Thanks for stopping by today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. Our production team is Colin Bergen, Savannah Ciccarella, Gene Davis, and Martin Matheny.
Next week on Athens News Matters, join us for a special, a collection of our interviews with all of the candidates for Athens Clark County Commission. With early voting underway for the June 9th elections, we want to make sure you hear from the folks campaigning for office. Join us for that special election edition of Athens News Matters at our regular times next week. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening.